The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Make America Civil Again, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Two Mackenzie was adopted from Vietnam. Now she's a college freshman in Wisconsin, where recently she was confronted by Trump supporters on campus.
It was Ching Chong, Asians for Trump, and then they followed up after I didn't acknowledge them with, "Do you even speak English?"
Her friend, a Trump supporter, was mortified.
It just totally, like, broke my heart that something like that would have happened to her.
Today on The World, we reflect on this crazy, long, and bitter election campaign, plus how the Brexit vote led to smaller chocolate bars in Britain.
If I brought one of these back from the airport and handed it to my little nephew, he would not be a happy toddler.
That's all coming up on this Election Day edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being here on this election day. We'll see very soon what election night has in store for America and the world. Either way, this has already been a historic race, and it could redefine America's image of itself and its image around the globe. We'll be hearing perspectives from a lot of different places this hour. In a few minutes, we'll head to Texas and later to Russia. First, though, meet a couple of the youngest voters in this election. Two Mackenzie and Madison Bao are college buddies, 18 and 19 years old, respectively. They're both freshmen at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and they're both biochem majors, so they're also lab partners, and they often study together. They don't see eye to eye on politics, but that never seemed to get in the way until a Trump rally was held on campus last week. On the way back from her lab, Tu, who was born in Vietnam, couldn't avoid walking through a line of those waiting to get into the Trump event.
There were chants coming from the arena, but you couldn't hear the words. Just that indiscernible sort of thumping and cadence was pretty almost physically chilling to me. And there were just people that I could just feel them like staring at me. Then a couple of them, as I tried to cut through the line, yelled to go back to where I.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
Came from, or that I was sapping off the government, and that I should be grateful. And I was pretty astonished. I'm not a very confrontational person. I'm pretty conflict averse, to be quite honest.
And there was one other insult that was lobbed at you that you mentioned on your Facebook post that was really, really insulting.
It was Ching Chong, Asians for Trump. And then I didn't even say anything. And they followed up after I didn't acknowledge them with, "Do you even speak English?" And
Wow.
I've lived in the United States for 18 years. Like, I was born in Vietnam, but I was adopted when I was 3 months old, and I had never experienced that before.
So you're a Clinton supporter. In Madison, you voted for Donald Trump and went to three of his rallies. After that incident that Tu went through, what was said, Madison? What did she send you?
She was like, "Some things happened last night that were really upsetting, and I just really need some, like, time." And so I was like, "Oh, what happened?" And she was like, "Just some stuff. Like, I don't really feel like comfortable really talking to you about it right now." And then later she said, "I made a Facebook post. You're welcome to go read it and whatever."
And
so
did
then
you?
I went and read it, and it just totally like broke my heart that something like that would have happened to her. Like, me knowing her, she is like one of the sweetest, most like compassionate people that I know, and. The fact that someone could just say that to anyone is just like shows how like downhill, I guess, people are starting to go.
Did it make you change the way you feel about Donald Trump?
No, because while that was one of his supporters, that doesn't necessarily mean every supporter is like that or he is like that. It could have just as easily been someone on going for Hillary Clinton that could just say something like that.
And yet a lot of people have said that because of what Donald Trump has said, it's kind of given people, his supporters, permission to be racist. That supporter was Tu.
Right. But to me, it's like, if you're racist, then you're racist. Like, it's, you're not going to just change based on a presidential candidate. But like, I'm a Donald Trump supporter, and I would have never in my life said anything like that.
Two, I'm curious, how many of your friends at school went to that Trump rally?
Almost all of them. All of my friends, except for my roommate, actually, all of my close friends.
How does that make you feel?
It was pretty isolating that evening after I came back from class and after I had gone back up the hill, past all the protesters again. I went back to my room, and there is another girl on my floor who isn't white, and I spoke with her, and we both felt pretty fearful, so we went to the cafeteria together to eat dinner, just to have that company, and the atmosphere in the cafeteria, the rally had just been getting out, and it was very frenetic, and I was pretty scared there also, and I went back to my room, and my roommate is a nursing student, she was at clinicals, and I couldn't focus. I couldn't concentrate. I had two tests that week. I couldn't concentrate on anything. I just sort of laid down in the middle of my floor and just tried to process.
Should being racist or remaining quiet in the face of racism, should it be a disqualifier for public office in 2016?
One person might say something that they don't necessarily seem as racist, and someone else might take it as that. Obviously, what they were saying to Chu was so obviously racist. But the fact that, just saying Donald Trump, some things that he said, if you take them out of context, could seem very racist. But if you look at the bigger picture, in my opinion, I don't see them as racist.
So your post, too, on Facebook describing what happened last week and these painful racial slurs, it spread really quickly online, shared more than 2,000 times. How did that make you feel?
My words when I wrote that didn't come from a place of anger, but yet many people used it to fuel their own hatred and feelings of frustration with the government and this campaign. They were using it to polarize their social media even further. And I was very uncomfortable with that. It was evidence for their arguments as, you know, the country is descending into demoralization and it's so sad and they were ashamed. And I was very conscientious in my post to be as diplomatic as possible and just to relate the event and how, I mean, my final statement was just to make sure that everyone voted today and it wasn't endorsing a candidate or slamming a candidate. There were some people that were claiming that I made it up and that I was lying. And someone even searched me on Twitter and YouTube and they said, well, Tu doesn't seem like she's politically motivated. And I'm not. I'm an 18-year-old college student and I'm sort of the mom of my friend group. I like to fix everything. I like to make it better. And I couldn't fix it. I had no control over the post. I couldn't defend myself. I couldn't clarify what I had intended my original message to be.
Yeah, going viral ain't all it's cracked up to be. Madison, what was your reaction when you read Tu's post?
I couldn't believe something like that would happen to her, just knowing her personally. And also it was sad that when she posted that, she didn't feel like she could talk to me about it. Because I'm a Trump supporter, I still don't think that's right. I still think that's totally wrong.
So tomorrow we face the post-election. The divisions will still be there, right in your own dormitory. It sounds like there are deep divisions. Can your generation get beyond them?
I would certainly hope so, because that's the next step to healing and becoming a more cohesive society. Certainly, Madison and I will continue to be friends. And, you know, there are certain times where I feel uncomfortable with certain topics of discussion, and we've only known each other for a couple of months, so it's hard to say how deep we can go with certain topics. But I think we both have a pretty respectful understanding of each other's values and beliefs.
Madison, how do you think you and Tu will go forward if we see more incidents like what Tu experienced last week?
Well, if I had been by her when that incident happened, I definitely would have said something. And I don't know what we could potentially do for society or our community to put an end to racism. But in our school, I think we could implement diversity classes, because if people are educated, they're not going to make uneducated comments like that. But then also people have to want to be educated.
Madison Bao and Tu McKenzie are freshmen at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Thank you both for your honesty and sharing the story with us.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Let's turn now to the world's own Rupa Shenoy. She hosts our Otherhood podcast, where Rupa explores how the U.S. is fast becoming a majority multicultural country. And she decided to spend this election day in San Antonio, Texas, because demographics.
Well, I, like a lot of people, I think this election might come down to the Latino vote, or it'll at least be very crucial. But pollsters have had a really hard time predicting what those Latinos are going to do. So I think in this moment, we're really confronting as a nation the diversity of Latinos, which is considerable. And I wanted to go to a place that really illustrates that. And San Antonio is a very blue area surrounded by a lot of red. So we have Latinos of both colors. And this morning I talked to the co-founder of the Hispanic Republicans of Texas Political Action Committee, George Othuna, who says many third, fourth, fifth generation Latinos of Mexican descent here don't necessarily identify with more recent Mexican immigrants.
Latinos in Texas actually are very, very different because of the history, how history played out in their lives. They fled oppression. They fled those kind of situations. And at the same time, they fought against dictatorships and dictators like Santa Anna, who wanted to keep them oppressed.
So Latinos in Texas, Rupa, obviously not all blue, not all red. That history influences them all today, though?
Well, so this is the place with the Alamo, right? San Antonio is home, right, to the Alamo. And so this was a country of itself before it joined the Union. And people remember that here. It's very present in their lives, including for Latinos, because many of them here have been here. They say, you know, the border crossed them. They didn't cross the border. Mm. And so they're still voting with that ethic. They have that very independent Texan streak. And Latinos, like many who have never voted before, are voting this time for Trump, the Republican Latinos. Not to say Trump was necessarily their first choice, but George says for many, it just comes down to the economy. They think Trump will do a better job. And they still have these memories of Mexico, Latin, and South America, where there's what's called a political class.
You know, you have political classes in Mexico, and the locals see them as they have everything, and they're making my life not progress economically. And so when they come here, they don't want a political class. That's the last thing they want. They want the capability to be able to earn, you know, their skill set. The folks that are not supporting her, I think, have everything to do with the fact that do we really want to go that route again, where we just have somebody that's been in politics for the last 30 plus years, or do we want somebody that hasn't?
I mean, it sounds like there's some resentment about that political class. They don't see Donald Trump, though, as kind of belonging to a political class, even though he's clearly the 1%.
I think Clinton is more of a genre that they can identify as the political class, and Donald Trump is a little bit harder to classify. He's more independent.
So Latino Republicans, do they have a hard time with Latino Democrats in a place like San Antonio?
Well, it seems like unlike non-Latinos maybe in other states, they're used to the diversity here. It doesn't surprise them. So when other Latinos don't agree with them or want to vote Republican or vote for Trump, that's just the way it is. They're used to it. I mean, they're used to disagreeing with other Latinos.
So what does the rest of your day look like this election day, Rupa, down there in San Antonio?
I'm going to election parties, big and small, and some in houses. I'm following around a Black Lives Matter leader. I'm trying to stop by a kindergarten vote to see how that demographic is splitting in this election. Yeah, and I'm going to follow around some millennials who are going door to door to encourage people to go to the polls.
And we'll be hearing some of those voices you'll be speaking with on Otherhood, and we'll be catching up with you tomorrow in San Antonio. Rupa Shenoy of our Otherhood podcast, thanks a lot for checking in.
Thank you.
How the U.S. election looks from Russia, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Soon, all the votes will have been cast across America, and we'll know who won the White House and which party will control each House of Congress. But for now, as we wait for the numbers, let's take a step back and talk about how U.S. elections compare these days with those in other democracies around the globe. It's a question the world's Mary Kay Magstad considers in the latest episode of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? You were a foreign correspondent for many years, Mary Kay, based in China, now a recovering foreign correspondent, as you like to say. Now back in this country, seeing it up close and personal, how does this look to you after years mostly in China?
What was interesting to me when I lived in China and elsewhere was that there was always this, you know, sort of love-hate relationship with American democracy. Well, you know, why do you guys think you're so great just because you have elections? You know, a government can be responsive without elections, and you can have elections, and it doesn't mean that you're necessarily a great democracy. And yet, a lot of people would look to the American system as something of a model, as, okay, so you have rule of law, you have more or less a free press. It's not perfect, but it's better than a lot of other options. I think over the last year or so, a lot of people have been asking, so what's going on with you guys? And I think, you know, this election season has done some damage to American soft power in the world in terms of, well, how is democracy really working in the United States? I think a big test will be, are the results accepted? And is governance able to, you know, go forward without one side continuing to try to block the other?
When you mailed in that ballot or those ballots, absentee ballots from Beijing, you probably felt pretty good. Different feeling this year for you?
One of the elections, when President Obama was first elected, I was in Beijing at an election party, and I was standing next to someone who was a senior official in the Public Security Bureau in China, who, when he heard that Obama had won, you know, kind of nodded and got a little misty and said, you know, that's really good. I thought, this is such a strange moment. But really, you know, it was a moment where I thought, wow, you know, America really does have something to offer in terms of an example. This time, you know, let's see what happens. I think this has been down and dirty and downright strange at times, but a lot of people have voted early, and a lot of people are engaged in this election in ways that maybe they hadn't been in previous elections. I think it does call into question a lot of things about people feeling disenfranchised, people feeling angry about the system. And those are actually factors that the Carter Center has found in its own work in trying to strengthen democracies around the world and monitor elections. You know, that can actually lead to erosion of democracies.
I mean, what is the picture of American democracy as the Carter Center sees it today? And are they worried?
One thing, you know, David Carroll, who heads the democracy program at the Carter Center, was saying there are a couple of things that worry him about the current state of American democracy, and it's mostly how people are feeling about it.
The degree to which people are unhappy in this country is the thing that makes me most concerned. The lack of efforts to really try to understand different points of view.
He did also point to the fact that in the 2000 election, which, you know, was, of course, fiercely contested, and to this day, you know, people from different parties, you know, will say different things about who actually won that election. But the Supreme Court decision was accepted, and the country moved on. And he said, look, you know, in many countries around the world, in such a closely contested election, that would not have happened. So in that alone, it showed that U.S. institutions worked. The Supreme Court just made this decision, and now we move forward.
With any luck, there won't be another Supreme Court outcome on this one today.
Yeah.
The World's Mary Kay Magsad, host of the podcast Whose Century Is It? Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Marco.
One of the things that's made this election kind of bizarre is Russia. Usually foreign countries sit back and watch the American campaigns play out. But in 2016, Russia has somehow gotten under America's skin. There is the apparent bromance between Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, plus the alleged Russian hacking attempts to disrupt the U.S. election, and of course the leak of Democratic National Committee emails this summer, which American intelligence officials have concluded was the work of Russian hackers. So what's the view from Russia today? I asked reporter Charles Maines in Moscow for that.
I was just actually mailing off my ballot from Moscow here and ran into the guy at the DHL office. And I asked him who he was rooting for. And he said Trump. And I asked why. And he said, well, you know, Clinton's so old. And I said, well, you know, Trump's actually older than Clinton. And that didn't seem to go through, you know, to him. He's never heard that before. So I think generally speaking, there's this kind of impression that Trump is sort of an energetic, young, upstart populist versus Clinton is more of a kind of entrenched elite, hopelessly corrupt and actually ill.
With a macho leader like Vladimir Putin setting the tone, is there some underlying sexism going on with Russians' view of Clinton?
Oh, I think so. More than that, it's defined by the fact that from Russians' point of view, and certainly from the Kremlin's point of view, Clinton is considered an anti-Russian candidate. Let's remember that back in 2011, 2012, Mr. Putin accused Clinton of, quote, giving the signal to Russian protesters who took to the streets to protest rigged elections here in Russia. And I don't think he's ever forgotten it.
There was one video that was kind of doing the rounds on Facebook, Charles. It was not Russian propaganda, but the person had gone to Moscow and was interviewing Russians. And they said, who would you vote for? And they all said pretty much to a person, Donald Trump. But then the question was posed to the same people. And the question was, if you were American and voting in the United States, who would you vote for? And pretty much everybody said Clinton. So what does that suggest?
Well, I think that they recognize that Trump is a candidate that's good for Russia, not necessarily good for Americans. So if you look at Donald Trump's policies from the Russian perspective, they certainly dovetail with some of the national interests that Russia has, whether it's looking at its policies in Ukraine, whether it's looking towards NATO expansion or even in Syria. There's a sense that Donald Trump would mean better times for Russians. Even just a news report that was in the paper today noted that, you know, if Donald Trump was elected, that means an end to Western sanctions. Mm. Versus if Hillary Clinton is elected, that means essentially nuclear missiles at our border.
Right. A future with BRIE or a future with nuclear annihilation. Take your pick.
Exactly.
So those accusations that Russia hacked the DNC emails and possibly hacked U.S. voting systems, they deny it. Meddling in U.S. elections or not, what does Vladimir Putin really want from this 2016 election? And do you think he's gotten it?
First of all, I mean, with the hacking, I mean, the Russians, of course, said that there's no proof. And this is, once again, an example of Russia accused of being guilty of everything, whether it's Olympic doping, war crimes in Syria, threatening its neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of what Putin wants, Putin himself has pointed out, you know, how do we know that this candidate, what they'll do once they're in office, whether it's Clinton or Trump. You know, my own view is that he wants a weakened, somewhat distracted and divided United States. It's not so much about trying to tip the election as it is about sowing doubt in the process itself. It probably resembles something like classic trolling that allows Russia to pursue its own interests while the U.S. is kind of consumed by doubt. But internally, it also has really important implications here, because showing the U.S. elections as broken, which is what they're doing in the Russian media here, that essentially plays to Russia's own future presidential elections in 2018. Mr. Putin has not announced whether he'll run, but I think most probably suspect he will. I think if you look at the way that the U.S. elections are portrayed in Russia these days, it's essentially saying, who are you to judge when we have our elections and things go wrong? The American electoral system is so broken and so corrupt that it's certainly no better and certainly no worse than Russian.
Charles Baines in Moscow. Always good to speak with you, Charles. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. A French journalist tries to figure out what makes Trump supporters tick and sees parallels with right-wing populist movements in Europe.
These populist rebellions are not going to disappear if the problems that have triggered them are not solved.
The U.S. election through fresh eyes. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This is it, everyone. We are getting oh so close to knowing the outcome of this long, bitter presidential election campaign. And people around the globe are tuned in and waiting, too. Because as we've been hearing throughout the show today, our presidential vote matters to the world. It matters a lot. One of those watching closely is Laure Mandeville. She's U.S. correspondent for the French newspaper Le Figaro and author of Who is Donald Trump Really? Laure recalls how at first, when Trump launched his campaign, she, like many others, didn't fully grasp the significance.
The whole of America just started laughing. But immediately the polls went up and he never went down. So that seems to mean that there is a huge anger against the establishment, a huge anger against Washington, and that he has tapped into this anger by bringing to the surface, you know, some themes which had been ignored, like illegal immigration, trade, the sort of falling apart of American manufacturing. I mean, all these themes sort of came to the surface with him, and it's like a wave, you know, so, that he's riding.
Mm. And just hammering away at those points, you think, is how Donald Trump was able to win over so many people?
Actually, yes, I think so. I think that illegal immigration, trade, nationalism, America first, And this idea that we're not going to be the policemen of the world, we're going to take care of our own interests. The question of radical Islam, I think all these different themes, you know, sort of appealed very deeply to the American people. And we should not underestimate, I mean, what that means.
You know, a lot of people say Brexit is the UK version of Donald Trump. But personality-wise, someone like Marine Le Pen in France with the National Front has also been cited as Donald Trump in a different wine bottle. Do you think that is accurate, or is he uniquely an American phenomenon?
I think there are parallels between the Brexit phenomenon and Donald Trump, and also between Marine Le Pen's appeal and Donald Trump. And I think that the commonality is really the sort of fear of losing your world. I mean, lots of these people are afraid of open borders. They see the sort of open-ended immigration of something which is going to change in the long run the heart of their country, and they don't want that. The British, I think, have, you know, voted the Brexit partly because they were afraid of losing, you know, the identity of Britain. And I think there is the same phenomenon in France, and in France it's very linked, as you know, to the immigration from North Africa, and of course has been reinforced by the series of attacks that we had, you know, terrorist attacks in France. At the same time, he's really an American phenomenon. I think that someone like Trump could not be possible in a country like France, for instance. I mean, this image of the billionaire TV reality showman.
It seemed to work in Italy with Silvio Berlusconi.
You're right. You could say that there are absolutely parallels between the Berlusconi businessman, also very much into show business, and his also his love for Putin that he seems to share with Donald Trump. Well, at the same time, I think that Donald Trump is different, and maybe would be different if he becomes president, because he will be, you know, constrained by the counter checks, which are pretty strong, I think, in America. Personally, I'm still optimistic about America. I think that your system and your country would survive even Donald Trump.
Laure Mandeville, a reporter with the French newspaper Le Figaro, also the author of Who is Donald Trump Really? Laure, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
They're also talking about the U.S. election today in Morocco. The country on Africa's northwest corner is perhaps the most Western-oriented Arab country. And right now, Morocco is also hosting the latest United Nations Climate Conference. Reporter Susan Phillips is covering the conference for us, and she's been speaking with people attending the conference, as well as local Moroccans, asking how they feel about today's election.
On a large, dusty patch of ground across the street from Marrakesh's old walled city, huge circus tents have been set up. About 25,000 people are expected to attend the UN's annual Climate Action Summit here over the next 2 weeks. And when it comes to climate change, everyone seems to agree that whoever wins the race for the White House matters. A lot.
It's a big boy. Whatever the U.S. does, it reverberates around the world.
That's South African delegate Happy Kambule. He may not be able to vote in the U.S. elections, but he did watch two of the three presidential debates this fall.
Interesting, to say the least.
No surprise. Kambule says the debates didn't give him a good sense of where the candidates stand on policy. But like everyone else at this conference, he knows that Hillary Clinton wants to continue the climate agreements and policies President Obama has signed on to, and that Republican Donald Trump wants to reverse course.
And obviously, if it is the Republican candidate, it would bring a greater level of uncertainty.
Another conference attendee, Marie-Paul Lusaba, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, also hopes Clinton wins. But not just because she thinks it'll be better for the climate.
A woman in charge is better. Because we are the one, we go in to fix things, and we are more effective.
Lusaba's excitement about a woman in the White House is heard over and over again from female conference attendees, as well as Moroccan women.
I'm proud of her, okay?
Moroccan college student Fadela Abidullah says she's followed Clinton's career since she was a kid. Abidullah and her friend Mabruka Haitsala are part of a large group of students helping out with the conference. They say there is no one in Morocco who wants to see Trump win.
We just never imagined that Trump will be in a president, and that's the point. So
we are a woman and want women to win.
Yes.
We support women.
Women I've met here are generally far more likely to support Clinton because she's a woman than the women I've interviewed back home in the U.S. But it's not just a gender thing. The Moroccans I spoke with just think Clinton is more qualified, both in terms of experience and temperament.
We know something about Clinton family and about the history. About Trump, I have no idea about him. This is a very important period for all the American people and for the world.
Sana Mobuji works in a hotel along with her friend Bata Megda, who is also rooting for Clinton.
Because she knows a lot of things about politics, and because she likes Muslims, different religion, and she's a political woman. We support women in the world.
College student Youssef Raou agrees. If he were an American citizen, the choice would be easy.
Hillary Clinton is not racist like Trump.
Most of the people I've spoken with here not only support Clinton, they also think she'll win. But Tomas Ayusu, a Honduran journalist covering the climate conference, worries that the rifts exposed by the election campaign won't heal even if Clinton does win. He went to school in the U.S. and worries deeply about what he's seen this past year.
I don't recognize the United States that I moved into to the one that exists now. Just the disbelief in the project. I think that those are the people that really do not believe in America as a whole anymore. They don't think it's working out.
For The World, Susan Phillips, Marrakesh.
Susan's reporting from Marrakesh is supported by a grant from the International Reporting Project. Immigration has been one of the main campaign issues this year, and on that front, the messages from the two parties couldn't be more different. The Democrats have talked about inclusiveness and welcoming newcomers. Republicans have opted for border walls and limits on immigration. The GOP's vice presidential nominee, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, also tried to ban Syrian refugees from his state. He didn't succeed, and his stance on immigration isn't popular with everyone in Indiana. Reporter Daniela Gerson tells us about one woman in Indianapolis who's helping to make immigrants feel welcome there.
Mary Clark works at Fairground, where immigrants have set up stands for the day. A Venezuelan chef grills arepas. A cafe sells Cuban sandwiches. It's hard to believe that this was once the place where the Ku Klux Klan rallied. Today, Clark is here seeking new business partners.
We do not have a Venezuelan restaurant in the international marketplace.
No, we are the first.
So I need you. I need you.
11 years ago, Clark helped create, in Indianapolis, probably one of the most diverse business districts in the country. It's called the International Marketplace. If you go, you might drive right by it. It looks like a series of businesses along any strip mall in America. But look closer, and you'll spot stores and restaurants representing more than 25 countries.
We have an African boutique, a Greek and Turkish restaurant, and a Chinese restaurant, and a Vietnamese restaurant, and on the back.
Clark is an unlikely promoter. She's never left the U.S. She grew up in a divided city, black and white. Then new immigrants started arriving, and Clark got uncomfortable.
And I remember having a young man that worked for me. And I said to him one day, and I'm like, why are these Mexicans here? Why are there so many of them? And he said to me, who do you think you are? Don't you know those are God's children just like you are? And that's the day I know that God started working on my heart.
At the time, she managed a bank in Indianapolis. The economy was tough, but Clark noticed new deposits from immigrants. She spotted a business opportunity, connecting newcomers to the larger Indianapolis community. People like Tonya Adaranke Wheeler. She's from Nigeria, and she runs a restaurant here. When she came to Indiana, she worried there'd only be native-born Americans.
But there's a lot of immigrants in Indianapolis. It makes me feel like I'm at home. Makes me feel like I'm back in Africa.
Adaranke Wheeler set up shop in the international marketplace because she wanted to connect with customers who are not only from West Africa.
I wanted to make sure that I include all the black Americans, just everybody.
Next, Clark visits an Ethiopian restaurant. It smells of roasting coffee. When some customers come in, Clark asks them if they know about the other places here too, including a Mexican butcher shop that offers the full experience.
If you go in there on a Thursday morning, you can see them slice up that pig, and it's a cool thing to see. It really is.
Kathy Suchet Mora, originally from Puerto Rico, loves this place. Before, she couldn't find one of her staple ingredients, plantains.
And now you can go anywhere in the international marketplace and find foods from all over the world.
Suche Mora, an aide to a local congressman, says the market also reflects how much Indianapolis is changing.
You know, I'm originally from Puerto Rico, and we're not considered immigrants, but when we would move from the island, we would go to New York or we would go to Florida. My family came straight to Indiana, and while some people still look at us a little strange for that, we came for a reason. Indianapolis and Indiana in general is a really cost-effective place to live. It's a community place to live. My parents came here for a family environment.
Clark wants people from outside Indiana to keep moving here and to feel welcomed. She hopes today's election doesn't change that.
So we would like a United States that all people are welcome to live in. It's really simple. Really simple.
For The World, Daniela Gerson, Indianapolis.
Let's take an election cleanse right now, if that's even possible. Chocolate always helps. Toblerone specifically. You know, those distinctive triangle-shaped chocolate bars originally from Switzerland. Well, the brand is owned by an American company now, and that company's just decided to change the way the triangles are spaced out in Toblerone bars for sale in the UK. It sounds pretty arcane unless you're a chocolate fanatic. The World's Leo Hornack joins me from London to explain. So this is strictly for the purpose of research, Leo, but what do you have in your hands right now and what's it going to look like in the future?
Right. Well, Marco, this required a great deal of research this lunchtime, my lunchtime. I have two Toblerone bars in front of me. One is one of the last old school bars. I'm opening it now. And if you could see in front of me, you would see exactly what you would normally think of as a Toblerone, sort of pyramidy, triangular things all along. And right. There are probably about a dozen of those spikes.
Yeah.
Now, that's that. I am now going to open the new Toblerone. I've never seen one of these before, except online. Here we go. I'm just going to move this up to the mic. Here you go. Whoa. This? Well, I mean, if I brought one of these back from the airport and handed it to my little nephew, he would not be a happy toddler because I'm looking at this and this is a different Toblerone. We've got about half the number of triangles in the bar. For every triangle, I'm holding them next to each other. In the old one, there's about double the amount of triangles. This is not the Toblerone.
Wow.
This is not your grandma's Toblerone, Marco.
So what's with this cutting of corners of the triangles here?
I wish I'd thought of that, cutting of corners. Basically, long and the short of it is, you get less Toblerone. You get less chocolate each time you buy a Toblerone bar in Britain. And why is this, Marco? This is because things are more expensive. And they haven't said this is specifically to do with Brexit, but it comes on the back of a whole range of products expected to get more expensive in my daily life as a British person. I mean, people who are pro-Brexit would say that this is part of starting a new chapter. And people who are anti-Brexit say this is about, you know, our lifestyle is fundamentally changing and our quality of life is going to change. But whichever side of that argument you fall on, this is about how real political and economic change actually affects your daily life. You're in the middle of a huge election and there'll be all sorts of fanfare when your new president is announced. But it's when it actually affects your daily life a few months or even years later, when you see things actually change in your shops, that's when it really changes people. And that's what we've just been through with Brexit. We had the fanfare, we had the referendum, we had the nail-biting finish. But it's now, months later, that we actually are seeing things like tea bags changing in prices, chocolate bars getting smaller. These are the real effects of how people vote on a big, big decision. And that's what's really starting to bite, if I can use that pun,
you
about
may.
A chocolate bar.
Our man in London, the world's Leo Hornack, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Marco. Nutty.
How the definition of American greatness has changed over time, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've heard a lot in this election cycle about American exceptionalism and how and whether America should go it alone in the world. America first, you know. That's how it was in the good old days, right? Without foreign alliances and commitments. Actually, no, says historian Larry Ferrero. Ferrero is author of an upcoming book titled Brothers in Arms. So, Larry, your book deals with the international help that America depended on to achieve independence from Great Britain. How do you understand the phrase America First? What does it mean to you?
America First, American greatness, American exceptionalism, these are all phrases that have been used in this campaign. And they've come to mean the idea of drawing up the bridge, separating America from the world, when in fact the original phrases meant something completely different. American exceptionalism, for example, originally the idea was that the United States would be an example to the world. American greatness was another concept that actually had its foundations in 1776, not long after the Declaration of Independence.
What was the actual use of American greatness in 1776?
A reverend at the time, Timothy Dwight, at a valedictory address at Yale, spoke about the foundations of American greatness as Americans not acting as inhabitants of a small village, but rather citizens of the world. All of these concepts, at the time they began, meant an American engagement with the world, not, as it is being represented today, an American disengagement or the pulling up of the drawbridge and excluding all from its doors.
So I really want to know when that changed. But let's go back to the Revolutionary War, because in your forthcoming book, Brothers at Arms, you argue that America has never been free of foreign cooperation or entanglements all the way back to the Revolution. So remind us what was going on then.
Just as those phrases were changed to a completely different meaning from their origin, the idea that America started out as an exceptional nation, fighting the British on its own and achieving independence by itself, was never correct and never a good fit. In fact, the American nation could never have won independence without the help of the alliances that it had with other nations, specifically France and Spain, and by the immigrants who came to fight for it.
And yet we are mostly taught in school that it was General George Washington and the colonists' inherent skill at ambushing the Brits that won the war, that America won its freedom on its own. Maybe there's that little sidebar in the chapter there on the French and Marquis de Lafayette. But you're saying the history has been wrong.
During the 19th century, when we had a manifest destiny mindset, the idea that somehow the Americans could have been helped by anyone other than themselves started to be pushed to the side. The idea of manifest destiny, American exceptionalism at the time, was very nationalistic. Yes, the history included people like Lafayette, but he was just there to help out. And you didn't see anyone else except at the very end when General Rochambeau came to assist at Yorktown. In fact, France and Spain were helping the American nation right from the beginning, before, in fact, it was even a nation.
The Constitution has parts that are dated and need evolving. Don't these phrases like America First and American exceptionalism, shouldn't we give them a break too and let them evolve as well?
I agree, but I think their evolution needs to return to their roots. We've been an exceptional nation for a very long time, not because we stand head and shoulders above every other nation in our character or in our temperament, but rather because from the beginning, we've been a nation that has both looked to its alliances and looked to the people who come from those nations that we engage with to help build and strengthen us.
Larry Ferrero, author of the upcoming Brothers at Arms, about the international help that America depended on to achieve its independence from Britain. Larry, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We at The World often turn to musicians to get their take on what's happening around the globe. So that's what we're going to do right now on this election day. Four artists from four different places around the globe sharing their thoughts about America's presidential race.
My name is Sofiane Ben Youssef. I am Tunisian, based in Belgium. Basically, you need something very bad happening to break a system that is settled there since so many years. And once the system is broken, then you can actually build a new one. That's what happened in Tunisia. We had where the system broke down. And when it breaks down, you have all the hope of building a new one, expressing yourself in a different way, finding a new balance in society, and actually experiencing life in a different, completely different way.
My name is Carlos Lopez. I'm from Cabo Verde in Hillary and Trump. I don't want to give you my mind who is better. And I want the best for your country, because if it's the best for your country, it's the best for the world.
My name is DJ Panko. I'm from Barcelona. The problems you have in Boston influence the problems that they maybe have in Sri Lanka, and the problems we have in Spain are maybe influencing the other place of the world. So if there is a war in Syria, it will affect us. So more and more, I think we have to make a global conscience, but this is something difficult, I see.
My name is Fada Freddy, and I come from Senegal. I'm really interested in, you know, discovering who's going to end up being the president of the United States, because this is going to be the window to the American face. The president is going to show to the world the new mentality of the American people. So this is very important, because I believe that the presidents that we choose reflect the society.
Fada Freddy from Senegal gets the last word there. Here's music from one of his more recent albums called Gospel Journey.
Let us pretend we've got it together. Let us ignore the coming song. We'll sing the body electric until the machine and soul are one.
Stripped out music from Fada Freddy there. No instruments, just voice and beatboxing. This track called We Sing in Time just feels right today. Election results will be coming in throughout the night, so stay tuned here for updates. We'll also be monitoring global reaction to the vote through the night with a live blog at PRI.org. By the way, I've also got a few thoughts of my own on this election and on what I need to do better. You can find that too at PRI.org. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow with a lot more to talk about. You can count on that.
PRI, Public Radio International.